Okay, welcome to episode 222 of the Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. We encourage anyone listening to join us and participate on the podcast. Check out the linuxlugcast.com for the server details. If you have any questions, comments, or topic you would like us to discuss and are unable to join us during the live show, you can send us email at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We have a subreddit for now, anyway, at reddit.com, r/linuxlugcast. We have a Matrix channel. We have a YouTube channel and a PeerTube channel. All of this can be accessed from the website. Honky and Joe are not with us tonight. They are embracing each other as we speak. And if that's not true, then they will jump on and tell me so. But if they don't come on, then you know it's true. So what we have is me as a temp host tonight, and I am Minix. Also, we have Mordency.
Hello.
Netminer. Who is he, deafened or muted? He is muted. So he's with us. Lovecraft.
Good evening, everyone.
And Cherry Hill Tony is in the chat, just hanging out. So, I thought for tonight, rather than do the same old, since it's us old guys on here, without the young bucks, we could do a little nostalgia talk, maybe? Talk about our early experiences with computers or with Linux. I had emailed Netminer maybe yesterday, seeing if he wanted to talk about anything, any special thing on his mind, and as well as whatever projects we're working on and stuff like that. And then if we need to fill time, we can go to the links. But us grandpas don't get to have the stage that often, so... we're kind of bullied around by the young bucks. So, yeah, it's our night tonight. Grandpa's night.
Speak so. For yourself. I'm about the grandpa's here, and, yeah, they were actually using ASCII when I started.
ASCII? See, you are a little bit before all of our time, Netminer.
Well, you know, paper tape, not mag tape, was my start. At a whole 10 characters per second. And a pie plate is great storage if you're using biodegradable tape.
Now, were you ever within the vacuum tube or the punch card era?
I believe my school was using punch cards. This was high school for grading and stuff. No. I did do some stuff on 370s over at MIT as part of their high school studies program. And in fact, the high school studies people were actually allowed to run our programs on 370s while the college kids were running them on a 370 VM. Yeah, I fiddled around with Lisp a little bit, not too successfully. And my first computer experience was on a partitioned Wang machine where everything was in BASIC.
Now, we talked about Wang before when we had gone over BBSs and stuff like that. Now, when you say 370 VM, is that the model number or is that VM for virtual machine?
That was a virtual machine. One of the things that the MIT people complained about is that the high school studies people, under the high school studies, we actually ran our things on, not that I could tell the difference, on bare iron, and the students were limited to the virtual machines. Of course, I also have read a lot of Ann and Lynn Wheeler, who were the people who developed the virtualization layers for the 360 Model 67, and which eventually turned into VM370.
Now, did they notice or did you notice a performance difference using a VM versus bare metal?
No, but then again, since this was a 1 hour on Saturday type trip, we got only a taste. It wasn't real computer use as any of us here would think of it.
And were you on the BBSs back then? Did they exist?
Well, they were probably starting out, but it was, I was probably in high school. I mean, I was in college before I got a machine that could do dial-up, and I got into the BBS thing. My first computer died because of bad power. It was a Z80, had 400K floppies and a very tiny screen, running CPM. Then later on, a friend of mine helped me build a PC, and I did some more dial-up stuff. Eventually, I also got a login at MIT on a BSD system. Started out as 1145, 1144, then turned into a, I believe, a small VAX. It was a multi-user machine using night TVs. Think of a multi-headed Hercules system with keyboard and mouse, black and white, and this system was originally designed to be the multi-console for the original MIT AI PDP 6 or 10 machine. I saw the original MIT AI PDP 10, but they never did get it running. One of the things that was amazing was that they had IBM tape drives, and MIT largely was a digital equipment shop. And they said the difference between an IBM tape drive and a deck tape drive is the deck tape drive, if you drop it off the back of a truck, you get a pile of broken plastic. If you drop an IBM tape drive off the truck, you get a pothole. Because the IBM drives were built like tanks.
Now the Z80 is kind of making a comeback as far as for hobbyists. I think last year we might have talked about this. They had somebody created a new OS for the Z80 called Zeal Z80. And you can run it, you know, you don't need a Z80 processor to run it, but you can emulate one. And I think that, and then what else? The 8088, did you have one of those?
Well, the 8088 is your IBM PC processor. Yeah, and I had an enhanced command processor called 4DOS, which is still around in a public domain version, as is DOS itself in something called FreeDOS, which can be run on emulated hardware or real hardware of the era, including Pentium 1s. There actually has been a virtual memory or a large memory version of the Z80 called the Z800 and Z8000. And people are still have been making systems with those that use bank switch memory and whatnot. a lot of actually is functionally equivalent to what the DEC PDP-11 had to do. PDP-11s had only a 64 kilobyte address range, but the memory management allowed them to have up to 4 megs of memory, pardon me, except for one 4 kilobyte page, which was where the I/O devices were located.
Now, what was networking like with these Z80s?
Well, networking was pretty primitive. A lot of it was proprietary. There were hacked versions of CPM that had their own networking extensions and stuff. When I was at MIT, they had a primitive pre-Ethernet called ChaosNet. This network, by the way, still exists, and it has been recreated for emulated systems, and there's a YouTuber called Mostix that has that, who's recreated that, or helped recreate that, helped recreate the Digital Equipment Corporation's proprietary networking. Again, I believe there may even be Linux drivers for these things. And then there's also a revived BitNet, which was IBM's internal or proprietary networking system for 370s and their big iron. One of the amazing things about the BitNet was it was not an IBM project. It was hacked by IBM sysadmins and system programmers because they needed to be able to connect the IBM systems worldwide. And it used VM370 as a key node, just because it was the only operating system that had any flexibility. The IBM's punch card, basically their primary operating system, MVS, was not flexible and could be an end node, but couldn't do the routing that they needed. And IBM tried to kill off VM370 many times, but it was a vital development platform. Also, VM370 could cover up some of the memory problems that their big operating systems had constantly, with memory leaks and whatnot, because it was easier to manipulate the memory at the VM level than it was at the MVS level. Also, because MVS 3.8, which was for the original 370 line, was developed largely with government funds, it is still out there and still being hacked and improved. Later, IBM operating systems took that core and overlaid it with tons and tons of other stuff that made it proprietary. But they couldn't lock up the foundation because it was government supported. And there are emulators that will run under Linux or Windows that can run the 370 operating systems. This guy, Mostix, gave one of his viewers a 370 system to use at home. It was running on a Raspberry Pi, an early generation Raspberry Pi. and he delivered it to Moscow or wherever this guy lived in the Soviet Union or Russia. I don't know exactly. Probably it was Russia at the time, but it was interesting to see this 370 decal on a little box that was clearly your Raspberry Pi case. And of course the Raspberry Pi had much more computing power than the room filling 370s that the systems originally ran on.
So the Z80 was your first home computer.
And it was my most expensive. I spent $2,000 on that little luggable machine.
And that's $2,000 at that time, not today's money, right?
That's $2,000 of $3.50 an hour wages.
And then you burned it up?
Well, yeah. For one thing, it was running linear power supplies, not the switching power supplies that PCs are used to today. And second, my dad, we were running on a very primitive wire installation dating from the 40s. It may have been 30 or 60 amps. And he was running a skill saw and a long extension cord, which dropped the line voltage in the house down, and my computer decided it didn't like that, and it burnt up.
Now, did your parents have any idea about computers or what you were into?
Well, my dad was one of those people. He would brag about what I was doing to his buddies, but he would disdain anything like that at home, because you couldn't reward your kids, because kids, after all, were supposed to be useful to the parents and all of that crap. And besides, with less than an acre at home, I couldn't ever achieve the kind of things that he did on 80 acres in the country in West Virginia. However, because I didn't achieve anything that he found significant, he could maintain his position at the high ground parentally. And he also was a master of chop logic, that he could melt people down emotionally, and then he would say, "I never laid a hand on you." Also, because we were not earning, we didn't have a paycheck, we had no value. He got a paycheck. And when I was working 360 days a year, 5 hours a day, that wasn't a full-time job, because it wasn't 40 hours a week. My dad had a heads I win, tails you lose attitude, which my mother supported. I mean, the parents were fighting, but they would not give their kids credit for being anything but kids. That's where my PTSD came from, domestic.
Now, did they have any idea whatsoever that what a huge role computers would play in the future? Or was this just their son's toy?
They had no idea. They had no idea that my dad's job could have been done, or a lot of his job could have been done remotely with a terminal and dial-up. Although then again, the house phone was a two-party line, so I had to get a private line so I could run my 300-baud modem. Also, my dad was intrigued when somebody changed the prompt on the whatever system that they were using to say, "Yes, master." before a command was input.
He liked that, huh?
Yeah, he found that cute.
I remember my I grew up with my grandma. My first computer was a VIC 20 that was handed down to me from a cousin's husband or something after he upgraded. And they had no idea about anything about computers other than what they saw in the movies. But they were supportive of me. You know, I would write programs for it, and my grandma would, you know, come in. I'd be really excited, and she would watch it and pretend like she understood what I was doing and things like that. So I didn't really have the disdain from my family like you seem to have had regarding your hobbies.
Yeah, well, if it wasn't for my grandparents' farms and the time that I spent there, where I was welcome and supported and whatnot, well, they saved my life the first, about 18 years of my life, since it was made quite clear in the house where I was, where my family, where my dad and mother lived, they had their name on the deed. And since the kids didn't have their name on the deed, we had no rights to anything in the house. This was not our house. It was my parents' house, and we were inmates.
Now, what about your siblings? Did you have brothers and sisters, or?
I had a brother. I have a brother who was my mother's golden child. And he bailed out into the army at age 18. I stayed on until my mother, well, until after my mother's death. And after I lost a job as a security guard, she made certain that to help me look for work in such a way to make certain that I didn't get any, because she would be hypercritical of my efforts to look for work. You see, if I'd gotten a job, I would have potentially moved out, and she would lose her house staff. That's why my nerves got shot, and I went into mass rehab, and they found out about my clinical depression, my PTSD, and my Asperger syndrome. Since the Asperger syndrome is a very logic-focused environment, mental wiring, it has been clear that my folks had to cheat hard to work their or be rigid to get by my logic.
Now, was your brother, was he into computers like you were?
Well, he bought a Radio Shack color computer for some gaming, and he would borrow my internet later on. But when he bought with me the color computer, he was not really into paying his share, because Ma never made him pay his share, so he would be very slow to pay. Characteristic. He could get any money that he wanted from my mother, oftentimes for bullshit excuses, but if I'd borrow $20, I'd better have it on or before payday, since he was my mother's son, and I was just the person who took care of her. So when my folks divorced and my father moved out, I was the one who took over. And of course, because she was my parent, alcoholic household, the parents tend to replace God as the, or, you know, they are right because they are right, and, you know, they beat the hell out of that. You should respect thy father or mother, no matter how nasty they are to you. Anyway, let's get back to some computer stuff.
So what about now? Is your brother still into computers, or is he into computers at all, or is that just you?
I don't know what he's into at the moment. A lot of...
Do y'all talk about Linux or anything like that?
No. He used to do gaming and stuff, and he spent enormous amounts of money getting a cellular internet plan and on gaming laptops of various kinds, which I would inherit after he'd beat them up. But now that he's married, he has other things to fill his time with. And I don't believe he's gaming anymore, although he may still have the cellular internet, I'm not sure, or he may get it through his company, through their cellular TV provider. I'm not really clear on that. I haven't really dug into it much.
What about you, Mortensy? What was your first computer?
My first experience or my first computer?
Well, yeah, your first experience with computing.
So I was in middle school, and I had one semester of a computer class, and we programmed on an Apple IIe. So I remember I made three programs. One of the high school kids that was a computer geek taught me how to put a null character in my folder name so the teacher couldn't look at my code. So that was one thing I did. Another was I went above and beyond. Like, we had to do one, two, and three, you know, in your program to make it run. The one was a store, and we just had to be able to buy an item and subtract it from the inventory and sell it back and add it back to the inventory. And I put random dollar amounts in it, and instead of just being a store, I made a whole story behind mine where it was a space station in Alpha Centauri, and everything was spaceships and weapons. And then my last program, my other program, we had to draw three shapes with three different colors. And I think that was it. We just had to, I made a screensaver, similar to the screensaver program where it draws squares and rectangles. But they were random sizes, random starting point, random dimensions within the size of the screen, and random colors. I got in trouble. A different high school student told me that I should call it LSD. So I did, not knowing what implications that was going to have on me. So the teacher spoke to my parents, and my parents wouldn't let me touch a computer after that. They had also seen War Games and the Manhattan Project and were convinced I was going to start World War III.
So their knowledge of computers was somewhat limited.
Yeah, so no computers at all from middle school on. And it was 1995. I started working at Bank One, so restaurants before that. And then I was working restaurants and a customer service job in credit cards. And got to use little dummy terminals, you know, to answer questions about people's credit cards. And I immediately surpassed everybody because at the bottom of the screen, it would say F1 for help, F6 and F7 for page up, page down, things like that. Nobody at all in the call center knew how to read, apparently.
To use shortcuts.
Well, so I'd be like, well, what does this field actually do? And when the cursor was in there, you could hit F1, and it just gave you a massive amount of information. Documentation I wish that exists today in programs. You know, like when you're filling out a web form or something, well, what do you mean and what do you expect?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, I decided to buy a car, a computer, a motorcycle, pay off my debt, and something else. There were five things, and I did all four of them except buy a motorcycle. So I ordered a custom built Pentium, I think 75, the 60 and 75 megahertz Pentiums were coming out, and I ordered a computer built before they were released. So it took a couple months. And I spent, I don't know, like between $2,000 and $2,500 on a custom-built computer. They recommended I go with a 486 with a 200-megabyte hard drive. And I went with the Pentium that had, I think, a 1.2-gig hard drive. Came with a CD-ROM. It was supposed to have a sound blaster, and it was supposed to have this 14,400 baud modem that I'd purchased. They ended up not putting the sound blaster in it and giving me a Win modem instead of the one I actually bought. And I just had problems for months and didn't know I didn't figure out what was going on. And they were nasty in the store with me one time and told me that I could pay a couple hundred dollars and get the sound blaster, which would solve my problems. And that was the first time ever I've made a scene. So my hair was short and I dressed nice. For the first year I was at the bank. So I was dressed nice, and then they tell me this, and I just blew a gasket and made a scene and said, you didn't put the it was $200 or $400 for the sound blaster 16 back then. And I was like, I paid for this, and you didn't put it in, and you want me to pay for it again? And everybody was looking at me, and they pulled me off to the side, and they checked what I'd purchased, and they hadn't put what I bought in. They gave me a stack of software for free, a bunch of games and encyclopedia software, all the stuff that was just coming out back in 95. Had 4 megs of memory, and I remember having problems playing, I think, Doom 2 or maybe Hexen. One game I was playing, it was just the screen was just so choppy as it was buffering and glitching, and I forget how much it was. It was $200 more than that for 4 megs of memory. And I put that in there and it just flew. It was so rewarding. But as soon as I stopped worrying about the hardware and messing up something, because everything was like warranty void if you open the case, you know, all these, you're going to destroy your warranty everywhere. And once I stopped worrying about damaging things, my learning curve just skyrocketed. So I knew maybe 5 people that owned a computer at the time. I just incessantly asked them questions and read books and those magazines that were like handbooks for upgrading your computer, how your computer works. And I very quickly surpassed everybody who I knew that had a computer, their knowledge. I remember Windows95.com. So my computer had DOS 3.11 or Windows 3.11 and DOS 0.2, I think. And then the website Windows95.com just had, you know, how do you do this questions, and they would have answers with the level of difficulty. So everything from changing the background on your computer, changing the theming, the mouse pointer, to changing the CD-ROM drive, to upgrading memory, editing registry, just all this stuff. Just learned tons. And then started playing around with FreeBSD in 1995 or 1996 and Slackware.
Is that your first open source experience?
Yeah. Somebody at the computer store where I bought my computer was telling me I should buy another machine and do FreeBSD. And he's like, that's what Yahoo is. Yahoo is some college kid's computer in his dorm. And that was what Yahoo was, where you were searching. He was indexing web pages. So my biggest problem was getting the graphical user interface to work in hand configuring the, what was it, X Free 86 for the graphics. And I never learned VI back in the day. It's only been in like the last 10 years where I've been able to go in and edit files successfully and save them. And I'm still mediocre with my VI skills, but I'm much better, and I push other people to use it. Every once in a while, I'll look up how to do something I don't know how to do, and I'll find new tricks.
I think you were probably starting out with something called 386 BSD. There was a big Dr. Dobbs project about porting BSD to the 386 platform.
It was 3BSD. I actually found the four-pack of disks from Walnut Creek and gave them to Hopper last week.
Oh, you... Well, I just remembered the 386 project from, because I was, of course, doing Dr. Dobbs. And it was amazing thinking of all of that horsepower. Of course, in college, I was using a CDC, I think 7600, it's a 60-bit word, and we were lucky to have printer terminals at 300 baud and glass teletypes. If you stole the line printer and fiddled with the baud rate, you could get up to 1200 baud on a glass teletype.
Hopper's going to take pictures of my old discs. I gave him just a huge stack of CDRs and store-bought Linux and open source stuff. My SU 7.3 box set, Red Hat 5.1 and 6.6.0.
But for you, the seed was already planted in middle school, but you didn't get a chance to actually pursue it until later on.
No. I grew up poorer than most people I've met. And then four younger brothers. So never had an extravagant amount of money. I remember scratching around and saving so I could buy a used 486 and ended up never getting it to run properly.
But what about your siblings? Did they follow in your footsteps of technology into computers and stuff like that?
They've all done a little bit. The middle one, who's a farmer and has a degree in welding and truck repair, also took database classes in college and apparently was top of his class in his two database classes. And I kept telling him that if he understood how to do that, that he should do that part-time and he'd make enough money to pay people to manage his farm.
He did. He wasn't interested?
Nope, no interest at all. Later, I found out my grandfather bought his farm for his wedding present, and then I was just like, don't complain to me about... He complained because I never bought him a car.
Because you didn't buy him a car?
Well, I gave all my other brothers my cars when they were in need. I guess the youngest one, my other brother, Mike, gave him his car. But yeah, he was complaining about that. And I was like, Grandma bought you 8 vehicles and you totaled all of them. You're not getting anything from me. Gimme, gimme, gimme. No.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, computers. Yeah. So I quickly surpassed everybody I knew in their computer skills and struggle and do the RTFM, figure it out myself over and over and over again. I'm reluctant to ask for help when I'm having problems, like with the Nginx proxy manager. I actually asked somebody at Self who was sitting around that wasn't doing anything, and they're like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm having problems with this. And first they were like, well, you need to read the documentation. I'm following the documentation. They're like, why'd you do it this way with the ports 8181 instead of just 81 and 8080 instead of 80? That's what the document says. And they're like, went over and I was doing exactly what the documentation said. And they, They go, well, why isn't it working? I was like, that's what I'm trying to figure out. And they showed me how to do Docker show logs tacf.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I started up. I did a change into Docker Compose with the file and started it back up and tailed the log and then pulled it up pulled it up in a browser and went to the certificates, you know, and it's just logging stuff. And I hit the HTML test for Let's Encrypt, where it sends a call back to Let's Encrypt.
Yeah.
And Nginx Proxy Manager was doing a core dump.
Hmm.
So they said, scrap that and install traffic.
Yep. That's a popular
something
one.
Else,
that's a popular
one. Somebody else told me to do Caddy. Somebody else said something else.
Caddy's popular.
But I got that running and now don't know what to do with it. And then I wiped out my Linode. No, that was on my Linode. Then I wiped out my SSD nodes.
Yeah.
Which isn't a container. It's just an install. Right? I don't think it's a virtual. Well, it's not a configurable virtual. It's 6 cores or 8 cores and however much memory and storage. I can't split that up into multiple deployments as far as I can tell. So I wiped Proxmox out on that and installed Rocky Linux, got everything working, and Nginx Proxy Manager just worked. I used the same Docker Compose from the other one. Can't get the certificates to work, but it's installed and up and running.
Can Let's Encrypt reach the internet?
I don't know where I'm at on that.
Because you have to open port 80 to get your cert, but then you can close it after you get your cert. So you have to make sure that's open.
I have to read the documentation, go back through and make sure I did all the steps. I thought I did that.
Yeah. That trips up people sometimes because you don't want to leave 80 open all the time. But yeah.
I was actually trying to do the DNS with the API for SSD because the DNS is on Cloudflare. So that domain, I have the domain on Cloudflare.
Speaking of that, here's just quick news. Did y'all see that Google Domains has been bought by Squarespace?
The business one or the sites?
The what?
Google Domains, is that a registrar?
Yeah, they sold it off to Squarespace. So that's who I'm with, Google Domains, so I wonder what's going to happen, like with my billing and stuff like that. That just happened today. Didn't you get Google Domains too? The $12 a year deal?
No. All my stuff is on Namecheap and Cloudflare, I think.
Oh, okay. I guess I'll find out when it comes time to what's going to happen.
So they had a retro install where they were installing on a 486, I think, at the Linux Fest.
Mm-hmm.
Installing with only documentation you had had at the time, like paper documentation.
Oh, nice.
You had to set up the platters and the sectors and stuff, configure it in the BIOS for the hard drive, and it was very funny watching all that go trying to get a machine booted up.
What were they installing?
I think they started out with
Slack or something.
It might have been Slackware, and then I think they ended up installing Lindos.
Oh.
I didn't stay all night. It was a kind of a long, slow process.
Was this from disk, from CD?
It was from CD. So they sat and copied the man pages over from the CD to the hard drive so they could access them without the CD in. And then that took forever. Seeing that scroll through went on and on and on and on. So then Ian and Hopper.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Ian. RC? Oh, you mean Ian I met at
a Cree?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the chat from Ohio Linux Fest. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, they live north of me, just over 2 hours. So I signed out from work on Wednesday, drove up and picked up Hopper and drove back, and we slept at my house and left in the morning and drove down to North Carolina.
He in with the FSF. Isn't he involved in the FSF?
Ian is. Ian never answered me. Eli. I'm sorry. Eli and Hopper.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
Eli is a Cree on the...
RC?
Yeah.
So they're into retro PC stuff. So I showed Hopper all the stuff in my basement. It's a graveyard of stuff. And we tested 4, 5, 6 different devices. One of them, the power supply went out. You could smell the smoke and the burnt metal.
Oh, as you were testing it?
When we plugged it in and pushed the power button, it went. And you could just smell it immediately. Like, recognize that smell.
The magic smoke. The
magic smoke.
The magic smoke.
I got to tell you, the most heartbreaking thing that happened, I was trying to put a card in my 386 SX40. Now, this was an SX, it's a 16-bit bus, which made it a snail. 40 megahertz 386 SX is a racing snail. It's the highest speed.
It's the highest speed.
40 megahertz 386 or 486 SX was what they were installing on at the Southeast Linux set.
Oh, okay.
Well, the difference is that the 486, I think, is a 32-bit bus. It's just cut down, no math coprocessor. The 386 is a 16-bit bus, SX, that is, and that would make any data transfer slow, especially if they were running one of the standard rates, 16 or 25 megahertz. But I had gotten permission to take some time. I was installing a card in this 386 machine. However, I didn't get permission to have time to actually do it from my mother. And when I plugged it in wrong and the machine was hot and it died, I was heartbroken. I mean, you could do stuff, but you had to double check that you had permission for, it was definitely, 1, 2, 3 red light, and she could change her mind in midstream, and there was no recourse. So I killed that machine, and I think the next one was a yard sale Packard Bell 1 gigahertz, I think, 16 megs, Windows 95 machine. Windows 95 being a trip. But yeah, I remember those early 386 hacks. I think I tried Slackware and I tried an early Red Hat. They were, and I still have the documentation because some stuff is in the old docs. It's not in anything current. Sorry guys for the interruption, but
no.
Go ahead.
I'd like to hear it.
So I feel like I started my computer career late. That was, I would have been 23 when I got my first computer.
Were you connected to the internet when you get your first computer?
Yes. So there was a local ISP in Columbus, and it was $20 a month, and I had that forever.
And this was at 14.4?
14.4. And then I remember splurging eventually and getting a 56K baud modem.
Mm-hmm.
It was always hard figuring out what was and wasn't a WIN modem.
What were some of the first things you did when you connected to the internet?
My goal was to play Internet Doom. That's the whole reason I bought a computer. And I ended up not doing that until about 8 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. On Linux with, what is it, PDoom? FDoom? There's an installer on Linux. And then you need the WAD files. So you can play all those old id games.
So Internet Doom, do you mean to play against other people?
Yeah, network. Deathmatch.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
I have discs full of expansion packs and deathmatch games. I think the one CD I have has 6,660 extra levels for Doom, custom-made levels.
Now, what kept you from playing Internet Doom at the time?
Win modem. Yeah, wouldn't let me pay. It didn't allow you to connect in DOS.
Oh. Connect to the internet at all, or what?
At all. You can only do it through Windows.
Maybe they don't know what a Win modem is.
Yeah, explain that.
It's all Windows software. There's no actual modem on the card.
Well,
no hardware at all?
Well, no. What it is it's all a regular modem has, or a full modem, like God and Unix intended, has some processing power and ends up handing your machine data as regular, honest-to-goodness bytes of stuff that have been decoded and have been handed into it, and your modem is hooked up as if it was a terminal. Your dialing commands are simply text strings. A lot of your signaling is done through text string error messages and stuff. A WIN modem has your processor go in and play with the modem at very precise timings and play it like an organ. So it has to do all of the stuff that the microcontroller on a real modem would do. And that means you have to have the Windows thing there. Everything has to be tuned so that while you're taking your modem, your entire computer, while it's taking in the characters off of the modem, is slave to that one task. So the computer can do very, very little. Can't do screen redraws or anything unless everything is very carefully slave to the modem process. The driver in there is doing the work of a $5 microchip.
So what kept you from buying a hardware modem, Wardensey?
It actually paid for one, and that's not what they put in.
Oh, that's right. Oh, that and the sound card, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then when I tried to go buy one, the price difference was like $10 for a WIN modem and $100 for a regular modem.
Oh, but you had bought one when you bought your computer, right? Or paid
they
for
didn't
one.
Put it, they, I paid for one. They didn't put it in.
Yeah. They never actually gave it to you, though?
No. I did get the Sound Blaster, which was good because I'd spent a month trying to get games to play. And I'd either have no sound or when I tried to configure the sound, it would reboot the machine. Because I was telling it to use a device that wasn't in my machine. And I didn't have the knowledge to understand it wasn't in there.
They took advantage of you, in other words.
Maybe. I would attribute it to laziness of door. They were kind of slacker hackers.
Mm-hmm.
They bootlegged Microsoft software.
Are you serious?
They printed off their own holographic details and stuff that were not Microsoft. I mean, they looked like they were, but I mean, they were definitely not the real. It was a pretty slick pirating. You know, because they were charging, what, $50 for Windows 97 when it was $100, and it was just bootlegged. It was just pirated. It was pirated. They made their own keys and stuff.
They installed a bootlegged Windows OS on your computer.
Well, that's possible as well, but no, they sold them in the store.
Oh.
Windows, DOS, some of the video games. They actually got money for coming and picking up old leased hardware, including government hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what they were supposed to be doing is wiping the drives. And they had the news, one of the news stations in Columbus did a thing about the safety of your information on computers, and talk about they had somebody who'd bought something from this store and had didn't even have to scan the drive to recover stuff. It just had tax files in it with tons of people's socials and date of birth and address, salary, like just everything you would need for identity theft and fraud. But they weren't wiping the drives. They were just leaving stuff on there.
So that store was on the news that you bought the computer from?
It was on the news that somebody had bought a computer there and all the information was still on it. But they were just talking in general about places with selling used computers. But yeah, they were supposed to be wiping them. So they were getting paid to get rid of the old leased hardware. Like, because a lot of companies will buy out their leases instead of shipping them back and mm-hmm. pay somebody else mm-hmm. to come and take them away. Yeah, so they weren't meeting their obligation on that. Later, I ended up meeting somebody who was friends with all of them. They had the store had other things going on. They would stolen pagers, and then later stolen cell phones. They would burn new things on the EEPROMs.
What is this place?
The computer store. Computer store in the '90s.
Ran by the mafia or what?
you saw Mr. Robot, right? No, it was it was run by just some like 20-something early phone freaks and computer hackers.
Very lazy ones.
Actually, 2003 is part of my rehabilitation. I had a internship with this computer cafe. And the way the computer cafe supported itself was by getting donated machines. We'd put them together, and this was Windows 2000 era. And the way you could get a $200 machine that was what was keeping us running was that this Office 2000 and Windows 2000 would magically duplicate themselves in the dark and disappear with the computers that we were selling. So that's largely the difference between your XP licenses and your Windows 2000 licenses and the licenses prior, is that Windows 2000 and prior operating systems were ridiculously easy to clone. And with XP, they at least made you work at it.
Unless you had an enterprise install of it, and then it would just work.
Well,
you could install without prompting for anything. Large corporations who bought just site-wide licenses for Windows, XP 2000, you could just install on every single machine that never prompted you for registry codes and stuff.
Well, I only knew about the 2000 stuff. Also, back in those days when things were in hundreds of megahertz, not, you know, on a lot of machines, I found out that you could load 2000 on machines with ridiculously small memories if the processor was fast enough. We're talking like 600 megahertz or something. So that was quite interesting. And that's where I got my one gigahertz, 32 megabyte DOS machine. which I haven't put FreeDOS on yet because it's a bit too power hungry for my budget, but I have one sitting around waiting for me to decide to do it on a cold winter's day.
I always had problems with the, I think it's Seal, the GUI for FreeDOS, or the one I tried running.
There are a number of GUIs. There's Gem. There's, I don't recognize Seal. There was Deskmate from Radio Shack. Yeah, there's been a whole bunch of GUIs for that. If you do anything, I would look into 4DOS. It's a command com on steroids, on speed, with growth hormone.
Yeah, so I used to multi-boot machines all the time with multiple operating systems, and I always had issues with that. When I got my ThinkPenguin laptop, I think I had between 10 and 16 operating systems on it. Because with GPT, you can have, I think, 99 partitions to boot from. I think that's the limit. But I was trying to run everything, and I had issues with things conflicting with Grub, especially with Arch and True OS, I think. And then had issues with graphic. I think I have a Linux or Intel graphics in my ThinkPenguin, and several operating systems didn't like that.
Yeah, your True OS is basically FreeBSD if you're looking for the root.
Yeah, FreeBSD with the GUI on there. Like Dragonfly BSD, and I think there's a couple other ones. The desktop BSDs instead of server BSDs.
I was having a lot of fun with my 2 GB Sempron 64 trying to get anything to run on it because it was a single core and the 2 GB memory was just a little small.
So when I did get my first computer and hopped on, if I remember correctly, there were less than 1 million people on the internet. Or no, less than 100,000.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. So it's the early days of AOL and CompuServe. And then I remember it hitting 1 million people on the internet. I remember the early browsers.
What was your first browser? Was it Explorer?
I had Mosaic. I don't think there was Explorer 1. I think it was Explorer 2. Netscape 1. I remember when Mozilla came out. I guess that was a little while later. Lynx on Linux. Mosaic, Netscape.
Did you ever use the AOL browser?
I did. I switched back and forth because during the browser wars, there was stuff that was on the web that only worked in Internet Explorer and only worked in non-Internet Explorer.
Mm-hmm.
So there was stuff I'd go back and forth from. I usually kept it around on a Windows while I was still using Windows. But mostly used Netscape and then Mozilla when it came out, which then became Firefox. I used newsgroups. I would scavenge those for information. And
so you discovered newsgroups. What about Usenet?
Well, yeah, that is right. That is newsgroups. Usenet.
Yeah.
So I had the news server that was free with my NetWalk ISP for $20 a month.
And did that come on a CD, like AOL CD? NetWalk?
Came on a single floppy.
Really?
Yep.
Now, my first logins over at MIT were not on the internet because the internet was a later beast. Probably it was still ARPANET at the time, which was a government network, and technically people had to have some kind of research connection to actually have an account. or have your login to your local machine would have special permissions that would allow it to go out on the net. Also, folks, when you think of your network service being slow, the original ARPANET was a network of 56 kilobaud synchronous lines. Yes, 56 kbaud synchronous was the backbone of the original proto-internet.
Now, Netminer, do you remember your first time jumping on the internet? Not the ARPANET, but the actual internet?
I remember when I got my Windows 95 machine, I was using one of those ad-supported networks, and it was interesting. Pain in the ass, but interesting. Of course, Windows 95's habit of eating itself was really interesting at the time, especially since I didn't have good backup procedures. But
every 6 months, wipe out, reinstall everything.
Well, I just kept mine sort of thumping along and hoping that the next patch set would replace whatever had been chomped on. I found XP to be heaven, which is why today there are people that would still be running XP if it was supported.
Was XP, do you think, Windows' greatest operating system?
Well,
I would argue 2000 was.
Yeah, well, XP is sort of 2000 plus, you know. Also, I spent many months paying $80 a month for dial-up, and I could support my XP over dial-up. Everything after that, I don't think you could support over dial-up.
So Windows 2000 was NT5, behind the scenes, the version number, and then XP was 5.1. It was just a minor upgrade, but I didn't like they took out the power of stuff that you can configure and update on your own, either through the command line or through GUI tools. They limited that, and I don't think it was any more stable or secure. I think 2000 was about their best product.
Well, the only thing that XP had was a bit more wide-ranging support. As you say, it was 5.1, and that's the one that I was with the longest.
Now, what was Windows ME?
Windows ME was home version update to Windows 98, and it was garbage.
Millennium Edition.
Millennium Edition. It was absolutely terrible. I never saw an ME machine run properly.
I always hear bad things about Windows ME, or I used to.
It was a hot mess.
Yeah, they were trying to keep a DOS-based Windows going. Also, a lot of the problems with Windows. First, the foundation of all the 9X Windows was the single tasking MS-DOS, sometimes with long file name drivers added, but it was basically a single tasking thing. So your Windows shell had to put a multitasking overlay on a single tasking foundation. Also, because everything disappeared into the operating system once installed, your libraries, what they call DLLs, dynamic link libraries, often conflicted because you'd get three versions of whatever it was. And a lot of Windows ME's problems was that it was seldom installed by itself, it was installed over Windows 98, and the different versions of the libraries would conflict, and generally that's, as you say, it was a hot mess, because nobody did a nuke and pave.
Yep, sometimes when you would install too, it would gladly prompt you about a conflict and let you overwrite something just if you wanted to, and then you're screwed.
Yeah, and then everything after that was based on the Windows. Well, they switched over to the Windows NT Foundation with different crippling keys in it, just like your Windows 2000 Home, your Windows 2000 Pro, your server stuff was all running on the same code base, but they had different registry keys that would disable certain.
So it was worse than Vista?
Yeah, well, the thing that they were doing with Vista is that they were pushing for an entirely new level of system performance. They're pushing for more graphics and a lot more processor horsepower that the operating system was chewing up.
Because the common complaint about Vista was it was very resource hungry, right? Slow, sluggish.
Yes, because what happened was that they were pushing for, they were trying to do Windows 7 on XP machines, and it didn't work. Why Windows 7 had at least semi-realistic system requirements. It also had several years of hardware technology upgrades, which is why Microsoft found it hard to displace, because it became another XP. If you had hardware that ran Windows 7 reasonably well, there was absolutely no reason to go to 8 or go to 10. And that's when I jumped ship, was from when they started forcing you through secret updates to update you to Windows 10 on Windows 7 machines. Then I jumped over to Linux, something that I'd always planned on, but I would have stayed with Windows throughout the Windows 7 cycle if Microsoft hadn't started playing dirty.
Now, Windows 8 introduced the Metro UI that everybody loved. Tiles, right?
Yeah, Windows 8, and one of the most profitable pieces of software was a classic shell that you could load in that would give you a start menu back again. I remember that. It's probably still out there somewhere. Also, I remember under Windows, even Windows 7, if you bought the right software, I could have, I don't know, what they call display link, I could have secondary screens, VGA screens, but I could have the multiple screens that Linux allows out of the box these days. Unfortunately, display link turned into another Win modem under Linux, because as far as I know, there is no efficient display link drivers for my old display link hardware.
What about you, Lovecraft? What's your story? How'd you get started?
Well, my first exposure to PCs was probably a friend of mine's older brother had the TRS-80 computer. I remember playing a game called Bedlam on it, loaded it in off of a tape, which took like, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes, I think. It was a text-based game, something to do with an asylum. There was a guy who thought he was Napoleon, I think. I think there was another guy. I thought he was Harry Houdini, and it was kind of a, you know, walk around, kind of try and solve a mystery. So we would always play that when his brother wasn't using the computer.
But just to load the game, it took 20 or 30 minutes?
Yeah, off of a cassette tape. There was no disk drive. So it was, it was on a cassette. It would take, probably about 20 minutes or so.
And that's the Tandy computer that Radio Shack sold, right? The TRS-80?
Yeah, TRS-80, Tandy Radio Shack. Yeah.
Trash-80, you call it?
Yep. So that was the first thing. But we were fascinated by it. We were, you know, we would play it whenever his brother wouldn't have it, be doing something with it. And eventually at school, we ran into another guy who had a Commodore 64. And that was like the machine to get. There's all kinds of games for it. And so we were hooked on that. And
now, was that new at the time?
It was newer. I think it had been out for, I think the VIC-20 came out first, and then the 64 came out after that. You're talking, this is probably around 1983, maybe 84, somewhere around there. And I begged my parents for one for Christmas, and I got it for Christmas one year, and just got the computer. And later on, I got what they called the data set, which was the tape for the tape player, you know, where you stored all your information. Didn't have a disk drive yet, so everything would take forever. If you wanted to write a program, save it off the tape. You got to load it in from tape. So it was slow going at first, but eventually got a disk drive for it. Then it was kind of in business, you know, could get some other programs, trade some stuff with people. And
get some games.
Yeah. And not long after that is when I got a modem, and that was my first real exposure to BBS systems as a little kid. It was maybe like 13, 14. Started calling some bulletin boards and talking to other people. And eventually was running my own bulletin board at like 15.
Oh, surprisingly, really?
Yeah, surprisingly, my parents were just, I wanted a phone line. My parents were like, yeah, we'll get you a phone line for Christmas. You know, I don't know. I was a little surprised too, but you know, these are also the same people who also went to Bermuda for a week and left a 15-year-old kid at home alone. So whatever, you know.
were you a dictator on your BBS board? Or did
I was pretty cool. You know, there was some message bases and a small amount of file transfers, you know, because it's running on a single, you know, 5 1/4-inch diskette. Everything, the entire bulletin board is on there, all the message bases, the file transfers. There was a kind of a decent sense of community with the different bulletin boards and stuff. A lot of people would get together at the mall, hang out at the arcade and stuff like that.
Oh, so these were local people that were on your BBS?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Tons of, you know, local people, a couple of towns where basically wherever a local phone call was, whatever prefixes you could reach. So, you know, malls were big in the 80s and stuff. So, you know, a lot of times in the weekend, you have some people from the bulletin boards hang out and, you know, get together, meet in person and stuff. So it was kind of a pretty decent social thing. So that was pretty enjoyable.
Now what? So to use your bulletin board from outside that area code, would that require making a long distance call that you had to pay for? Or?
Yep.
Yep.
And long distance was not cheap back then. If you had like a friend or something who had a bulletin board that was like a toll call, depending on how the things worked, the phone company did have something they called it a scope, and it would extend your local range for a certain amount of hours, like 20 hours. But it was like, you know, each one would be like maybe like $5. So for $5 a month call, like this one other exchange that might be just outside of your normal range, so you could call that bulletin board. But I lived in an area which I was pretty centrally located, so I had quite a few places I could call. I mean, I probably had, like, at one time, maybe 40 or 50 different bulletin boards that I could call for free. But I mean, a lot of these bulletin boards, they didn't last. I mean, they might've been around for a few months. There was even a couple of bulletin boards that wouldn't, come online till 9 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night. And then in the morning they would be off. So I guess they didn't have a dedicated phone line or something like that.
But did your board just stay on all the time?
Yeah, mine stayed on all the time. It was just, I had it, in my bedroom. And then if I ever wanted to, make a phone call and talk to somebody, I had my own phone line. I would just pick up the phone and dial them. And if anybody was trying to call the bulletin board, they would get a busy signal. But it worked out pretty good.
But now how long did your board stay up?
Probably for about 4 or 5 years.
Wow, really?
Yeah. I had it down for a while. And then in the early 90s, I guess around 92 or 90, maybe a little later, maybe 94, I brought it back on the PC, because the original one was running on the Commodore for several years. I obviously switched software. I was running on the PC. I was running something called Synchronet, which was, I actually think, the one you called that one bulletin board on the show a while back.
Yeah,
that was running Synchronet. That's still around. I think the guy who wrote it, I think his name is Rob Swindle. And that had a, I think he was the person who developed a, something called DoveNet, which was like something smaller than FidoNet, which had, network message bases and stuff. So different bulletin boards could, send messages and back and forth to each other, or you could have a message base that was, shared throughout all the nodes. And
what do you think led to the decline of bulletin boards, just like internet forums and stuff? Or
I would say with the popularity of the internet, I mean, it kind of dropped off. There's also kind of a, I'd consider a somewhat higher technical barrier to entry. You pretty much had to know what was going on and want to go through all, jump through all the hoops and stuff like that. And it's, to make that connection.
Now, did you have to buy the software, the BBS software?
On the Commodore? No, no one really paid for Commodore software. but it was the BBS software. It was very, very basic. On the PC, Synchronet. Yeah. But that was purchased. It was cheap. It was like, I think it was like, I don't know, like $69 for, a forever license for the software. Mm-hmm. So it was worth it. Plus, obviously it supported a guy. I mean, I believe this guy was making this. This was his sole source of income. So, he needed to get paid.
Yeah. I guess the early 90s, too, is when chat programs started to become popular, like AOL chat and whatever, Yahoo Messenger and things like that. So you could instant messaging, versus BBS boards.
BBS boards. IRC.
IRC. Yeah, IRC. That's right.
Yeah, yeah,
that's right.
Most of them used, you could use IRC commands, and I think Yahoo, and definitely an ICQ.
Oh, ICQ, yeah.
Oh.
I loved ICQ.
I got a couple of things for you. First, AOL is alive and well and buried, or at least the software is still buried in the Ubuntu repositories. Underdocumented as hell, of course.
Is it the AOL Instant Messenger?
No, it's AOL, the entire AOL server.
Hmm.
Also, people are talking about Usenet. Usenet was started out as a couple of colleges with Unix machines, I believe, exchanging messages through Unix to Unix copy. And what happened was that eventually this would end up being a mesh of different machines where one guy would relay down to the next guy, and then the next guy would relay down to the next guy through what they called bang routing, because the bangs was what they used to separate different systems. And eventually, you could even get a news server program for DOS. You just have to find somebody to give you what they called a leaf node off of their Usenet feed. So the same sort of stuff that was being done by the microcomputer bulletin boards, going bounce, 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 bounce down, bounce to maybe a central system for somebody who had more resources, bigger computer, more disk, what have you, more phone lines. But the same stuff that was being done at the microcomputer level was being done at the university mini and mainframe level. So your Usenet and your bulletin board message bases and your FidoNet or whatever your other networks that were based on, whether it was an Apple machine or a Commodore or, you know, whatever, they all were doing basically the same thing, transmitting a lot of stuff over dial-up connections. So when you talk Usenet, you're talking about the big brother of the same bulletin board systems that the micro guys were using.
Now, Usenet was the original decentralized platform, right? Everybody talks about decentralization now to save the web. Well, this was going on way before Web 1.0 or whatever was even implemented.
Well, Usenet was the original big machine decentralized network. FidoNet and the networks that were connecting up the micros was the original desktop decentralized network, which I believe there are still some of these networks are still around for emulated machines or for those that just want to do dial-up or even connect through the internet. A lot of the bulletin boards have gone to Telnet based systems. In fact, is a lot of your early micros can be put on the internet by something that looks to the micro like a Hayes modem and actually speaks to your Wi-Fi or your Ethernet using a microcontroller or something like that, or little Raspberry Pi that responds to extended Hayes commands. So you can have your TRS-80 thinks that it's talking to a dial-up modem, and it's actually talking to a microcontroller that is talking to your Wi-Fi, which is talking to the internet and is talking to a TRS-80 bulletin board running over Telnet. So the bulletin boards have mutated back to their roots. A lot of them are using the internet as their carrier instead of a circuit-linked phone line.
So, Lovecraft, you went from the Commodore 64. No, you went from a TRS. Well, that wasn't your computer, right? The TRS-80. That was your friend's.
It was my friend's older brother. So, I had the Commodore. 64, and I did have an Amiga 500 for a little while. And then in 1990, I got the my first PC. It was a 386 SX 16.
And what were you running on there?
DOS 4.01, I think it was. That was fun. I really enjoyed DOS when, Windows was just more of a mess, but I kind of like the command line stuff, just easier to work with. There was a couple of really good programs that I liked. There was one program called Xtree Gold. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that, but that was like so easy to manipulate files and get things done. And it was just really, really good stuff. Then around, let's see, it was 1991 would have been the first time I did anything actually on the internet. I had a friend of mine who was going to a university, and he had a dial-up Unix shell account, which I convinced him to share the password with me. And I was, again, lucky enough to live in an area where it was a local phone call to dial in and, start playing around, and kind of interesting to just kind of see what could be done. But that was interesting. You could use the use Usenet, get on some of the different boards. It did have access to the binary files in Usenet, so you could download some stuff to the to your drive, if as long as it was within your quota, download some files. It was just kind of neat stuff, and use that for couple of years. Then I now, got
were
a
you,
job.
Were you into gaming at all at this period?
A little bit of gaming. Some of my friends, we would, whenever Duke Nukem 3D came out, we were doing some DOS-based network gaming. We would all trudge over to somebody's house, bring our computers, get some DOS-based networking going using Lantastic, which was a Novell product. We get like four computers together, get some beers, and just
have a LAN party
game. Yeah, along with all the inevitable technical issues that would come along with it, but it was a challenge, but it was a lot of fun. But we would we do Duke Nukem was probably the big there, Duke Nukem 3D rather was the big one we would do. And later on, we got into Heretic, and I think we did either Hexen or Heretic 2. I can't remember. I think we did, can't remember which, probably both of them. But Duke Nukem 3D was the big one. Everyone really liked that, and we really played the heck out of that, and for a number of LAN parties.
Came here to kick ass and chew bubble gum, and I'm all out of gum.
That's the best line out of that. Oh, there was one more too that we played. Blood was another one of those games.
I think I had Blood 1 and 2 and expansion packs for both of them. I didn't get to play the
plasma packs.
Plasma packs, yeah.
Yeah, that was another fun one. That what quote did that? Oh, that was that had the "we're going to need a bigger boat" quote from Jaws in it, I think.
It also started up with him coming out, Caleb coming out of the grave, and he says, "I live again."
Yeah. Yes, yes, yeah. Such good stuff. So yeah, a little bit of gaming.
And the Lovecraft cult people in it.
Yeah. I love cults.
Actually, I had a sort of web browser that would work through a dial-up modem, and I ran a Free Pascal. This is a 32-bit long file name Pascal. Some people say that they were spoiled by BASIC. I was spoiled by Pascal on the big CDC machine, although the CDC Pascal was beaten like a rug by the Borland products, which I also put on my DOS machine. especially once I'd gotten the patch that allowed me to run it on the 1 gigahertz or whatever processor I was running. Borland Pascal, out of the box, didn't like fast processors. But Free Pascal, which has been morphed into a Delphi-compatible thing called Lazarus, which is Delphi Resurrected, I was able to run that on the DOS machine by dint of the most lecherous combination of long file name drivers and generally tortuous hacking. And again, I actually had the PDF documentation printed out for the Generation 1 DOS stuff. I mean, I had it printed out commercially off of the PDFs. But you can do some amazing stuff with DOS if you torture it enough.
Now, did you ever get into gaming, Netminer?
No, I didn't get into gaming. I did get into getting software off the network and other graphical files of a visual nature, but no gaming. I followed some Usenet groups when I could. There was a big thing where New York or whatever didn't like some of the material that was showing up on Usenet. Illegal imagery, and a lot of the ISPs dropped all news groups to get first it solved a lot of disk storage problems, and they said, well, we don't want any of that nasty stuff. So you had to find a Usenet provider and hook into them. Also, what else was I thinking about? That's what happened. And there also is an outfit called Eternal September, which provides free Usenet stuff, and the name is after AOL or one of those started having news groups as a primary stock and trade. The Eternal September quote is because back in the day, students would go to college and they would get their dial-up accounts and they would in September and they would have their Usenet access through their accounts at college. With AOL or whoever it was doing it, this surge of newbies on Usenet was not just in September, but it was year-round, so that's why they named their free service Eternal September, because everybody's always joining Usenet, so it's always September. Thank you. Next.
So you're at DOS 4.1, Lovecraft. And what happens next?
A couple of years later,
you got the Unix login, right? The shell login.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I had that since about 1991 or so. I had that for several years, even after my friend graduated. The university still let him keep his account. Sometime in there, I was working at a place, it's now at a business called Egghead Software, and doing software sales, hardware sales, that kind of stuff. And I was fortunate enough that there was a nationwide ISP called Netcom, and they gave all of the salesmen free internet They had all kinds of local dial-ups and stuff like that. So that was my first real taste of graphical internet with a, you know, actual graphical web browser. It was using Netscape. I'm not sure if it was Netscape Communicator or if it was the just still the Navigator at that time. So that was kind of interesting.
It was a whole new world opened up.
Yeah. It was, I guess sometime in there I got a 14.4 modem, maybe even a 28.8, something in somewhere in there. So decent speed, you know, handle all the graphics. That was pretty good. And a couple years after that, I found myself actually the same university that I had the dial-up account from. I found myself working there. Went in for a job interview, and there it was a part-time job. And they're like, okay, well, we're going to make you the lab manager. There's 5 computer labs on campus. And since you're not a student, that means you're the manager. So I had one person who was a student who was my helper. And it was just a lot of, you know, making sure that all the printers were full of paper. But they told me I wasn't allowed to leave the main lab that I was working in. So I had to make sure that the other guy would go fill up the paper, take care of any printer problems. But I was supposed to stay there in the main lab, which was actually the lab that all the computer science people were using. It had a bunch of Spark workstations in it. That was my first real exposure to Linux. They actually had a bunch of their systems ran on I think it was SunOS 4, and you had to, you know, you had to do this whole process if somebody forgot their password. But that's why they didn't want me to leave the lab, because I was the only one who could change people's passwords, and students were notoriously horrible with remembering passwords. So yeah, it was an interesting job. I ended up working there stayed there for about 5 years. And some point during that time is when I started working at the hospital. That was 1999, I guess. I started working at the hospital and was doing both the jobs for a while, because the computer lab manager job was at night and one day on the weekend. So yeah, that's kind of my journey.
What got you into Linux? Was SunOS at the computer lab?
I started doing some exploration on my own. And I guess it was around maybe right before I started working at the hospital, early 99, maybe. I stumbled across Mandrake Linux. And that was not successfully installed. There was a lot of problems. I mean, there was just all kinds of technical issues and botched installs, but it was something that I was really interested in. I had a couple of friends who were interested in it. None of us could get it installed correctly on our machines. And I was kind of always aware of Linux, but once I started working at the hospital, that was like an all Windows shop. And a few years after I started working at the hospital, a friend of mine got laid off and was trying to figure out what he was going to do next. And he approached me and was like, you know what, we should start a computer repair shop. And I was like, yeah, but I have a full-time job already. He's like, yeah, we can work it out. So from 2004 to 2019, I also was the co-owner of a computer repair business. So I was keeping pretty busy.
Yeah.
For a while there. But now I'm committed to trying to get rid of everything Windows. I just, with the direction things are going, I just can't deal with it anymore. It's too much.
So what are some stories from your computer repair business? That sounds interesting. Any interesting tales or situations?
Oh yeah, lots.
You ever have to call the cops on anybody for what you found on their computer?
No, there was a couple of close calls. We did have someone bring a computer into the shop one day, and it was a kid, seemed really super nervous. He was like, "Oh yeah, can you guys get this password off of my computer for me?" And you know, it was a MacBook, and we're like, and, you know, started asking him a couple of questions about it, like how long he's had it, and he's getting kind of nervous. And we're like, yeah, well, we can see what we can do about this. And luckily, we called the cops. Turns out that somebody had reported it stolen.
Mm.
And the only bad thing about it was this kid, he lived in an apartment complex, and his dad was the building manager for it. He was stealing his dad's keys and robbing apartments.
Oh, wow.
So that blew up. But the police were, you know, we told the guy, yeah, we can't get the password off. You can come back in and get it. And we had, there was a detective there and kind of arrested him. And we found out later on about, you know, unfortunately the kid's dad lost his job because of that.
Oh, but damn.
He was doing the right thing, but you know, there's some other interesting homes I had to go to.
Did you do house calls or whatever?
Yeah, we did home, fair amount of businesses. We did a lot of dental offices, lawyers' offices. I went to this one service call, and this is the town I grew up in, so I knew the town very well. And this house happened to be the home that the only murder that ever took place in the town was committed in. And, you know, I was kind of talking to these people, and I was trying to feel them out about, like, oh, this is such a nice house here. Cause it's at the kind of end of this dead end street, and, you know, a lot of trees around. It was real pretty.
You knew the history of the house before you.
Yeah. Went. Yeah. When I got there, I realized what it was. The house is right down by this lake. And it happened when I was in, junior high school, actually. And I was like, oh, so, you know, how long have you guys lived here? And all this stuff like that. I'm like, yeah. And they never let on that they knew about the house. But I'm like, oh man, this is like creepy. Cause now I'm looking around the house like, oh, where actually was this body? You know, I'm trying to think all this stuff, but, that was an interesting one. Went to a hoarder house one time where,
oh boy,
people had like probably 7-foot stacks of bundled up newspapers. It was like a maze to get to their computer. Got to their computer, start troubleshooting everything. Turns out they didn't pay their cable bill. So
they were trying to get online and couldn't.
Yeah. And like, yeah. So you're going to have to pay that bill to get it turned back on. So I'm like, you know, we could like settle up now, or I can wait here till you can see if you can pay the bill. They were more than willing to pay me to sit there while they called Comcast to get their cable modem turned back on. I'm like, well, okay. And you know, they got it done, but I'm like, all right.
That was the hoarders.
Yeah, that was the hoarders. Yeah, there was a bunch of stuff. I mean, typical, bunch of spyware, porn infections.
Oh yeah. I bet a lot of your job was just trying to fix viruses and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we had one guy. Yeah, I mean, we fixed his computer, and he was back later the same day. He's like, I can't control myself. It's got a bunch of porn pop-ups on it again. I'm like, yeah, you're gonna need to get like a better protection plan from us. So we upsold him on, I think like a full-blown version of Malwarebytes and some stuff. But yeah, it's just interesting. A lot of people just. It was good. It was good community and stuff, but it was just getting to be too much. It was almost 15 years. So while having another job, so it was time to give it up. So I had my partner bought me out.
When I was in college, I worked for one of those rent to own places, you know, And we would we had computers that people would rent to own, and there was always problems with them. Well, they never took care of them because they'd just rented to own them. So we'd have to go to their house and see what was wrong. And I remember one computer. First thing, I walk in the house, and there's like dog turds everywhere, and I accidentally bumped this picture on the wall. And these roaches just went everywhere from behind the picture frame, all over the wall. And I was like, oh, my God, what am I going to have to do to this computer? So I walk through this trail of dog turds to this back room where the computer is. They got foil all over the windows, so I can't see what's going on. And the light doesn't work. So I'm like, it's a nightmare dungeon, basically, with dog turds and roaches everywhere. So I can't get the computer to turn on. I unplug it and take it into the kitchen where I can see. And as I'm taking the side panel of the case off, all these roaches come out from the computer and just run all up my sleeve and all over my hands and stuff. And I was like, okay, I'm done. I can't do this. I said, you're just going to have to make another appointment because I've got, I don't have time to deal with this right now. And when I got back to the shop, I said, I'm never going there again. I said, you can fire me if you want to, but I just, I couldn't handle it, man. And we'd bring it, people would, you know, they wouldn't pay their bills. So we'd have to go pick up the computers and stuff and bring them back, and they'd just be loaded with viruses. And that was the first time I saw like really weird freaking porn too, was on some of these computers. I remember the first image I saw, that I just like, what in the hell was this lady with her legs spread and like a giant fish was put inside.
I didn't believe the animal stuff was real when I got on the internet until people started sending me links in email chains, people that I worked with. And I was just like, I'm never opening email from this person again. And then working on people's computers all the time, cleaning up spyware, malware. One of the first things I'd ask is, what you want me to do with the porn on your machine? And everybody's like, there's no porn on it. It's like, okay, so what do you want me to do with it?
Yeah, right. Every computer
There were a couple people out of the like hundreds of computers I worked on from people I worked with that I believed them that they didn't put it on there, or didn't have a kid that put it on there. But most of them were, one level of trickiness hiding where it was, and there was usually files that were infected with malware or viruses. I had to just go, once I saw a couple pictures in a folder, I'd just purge everything in that folder because, I saw some stuff. I didn't believe the animal stuff existed. And then later...
Unfortunately, you can't unsee it.
No, you can't.
I still remember that. I want to elaborate, but I saw one with a lobster. You guys can use your imagination.
Yes, tail first.
Were we looking at the same picture?
probably not. Octopus, eels, dogs, horses, gerbils. Thought the habit trail stuff was a joke.
Gerbil urban legend going around here 20 something years ago or something about a local newscaster and a
We brought one computer back to the store that we picked up, and the guy was like bragging about it. He called and said, "Yeah, you need to look in this folder. You're not going to believe what you're going to find." We opened the folder, and it's like, "Yeah, you're right. I don't believe what I'm seeing in here. I should probably call the cops on you right now for being such a fucking weirdo."
I remember about 10 years ago, Mr. Hands. Maybe a little more than that. The sex farm in Oregon or Washington State.
Died
from the horse. But it was a sex tourism business because it was legal. And when people were discussing that, there's no way that's legal. We looked up the laws, and it was like legal in 26 states, 36 states. You have to implicitly have a law against it.
Really?
Yeah, most states didn't. I would think after that, most of them have changed their laws. I know in Washington and Oregon, it only fell under animal cruelty. So you had to prove that that it was cruel to the animals, whatever was being done. But yeah, stuff that will never leave your brain. It's,
That's one thing the internet did do to me. It harmed my brain. It bruised my brain in a way that will never be right again.
I couldn't imagine growing up today with the internet, that with full access to that. That's
Yeah,
wow.
at the time I was old enough. I was an adult when I was seeing this stuff, but just to see it as a kid, oh man, I don't know. Like when I was younger and my friend had a Commodore 64, he had Leisure Suit Larry, and man, that was seeing these pixelated boobs and stuff. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe what I'm seeing. He had strip poker and all this other stuff, but it was just like cartoonish pixel graphics, not even online or real pictures. If you wanted a real picture, you had to wait forever for it to download. So we didn't even bother.
It was only a couple hours.
Yeah, but just if we could see Leisure Suit Larry or strip poker, we were just kids. That was good enough for our imaginations.
I remember playing strip poker on the Commodore, and we got the bright idea. We can just rename the last file to the first file name, so it would just girl would just load up naked.
Right at the beginning.
Yeah,
Didn't even have to work for it.
it was like a series of like maybe five or six files, and I was like, oh, we'll just rename the first file to like a dummy name, and then rename five to what number one used to be named, and then boom, there you go. We win.
Yeah, that was an interesting job I had. I didn't work there too long. For one thing, it's just a kind of a scummy industry, the whole rent to own deal. The interest rates they charge and all that stuff. So I did it. I was just in college trying to get by, and so I remember what made me quit was going to a house that had a refrigerator that they had rented to own, and similar to that computer, the power was off. They didn't pay their bill, and we had to go pick up the refrigerator. I don't know how long the power had been off, but I could smell something before I even entered the house, or it was a trailer actually. And we go in, oh my God, my eyes are watering. It smells so bad because they left all the food in the fridge. And I'm hesitating to open the fridge. I'm like, let's not open it here. Let's just get it on the dolly and get it out of here, and then we'll figure out what to do next. But as I'm doing that, I'm standing next to the fridge and I hear this like scratching noise, barely hearing the scratching noise, and I put my ear next to the fridge and I could hear all these little legs crawling up and down inside the door of the fridge. And that was it, man. I said, I'm done with this
Like a
job.
Lovecraft novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't worth it, man. And they had gotten into the door itself, like not even like you had to peel away the trim, the insulation, and then inside the door was just full of cockroaches. Once we got back to the shop, we didn't. Our boss wouldn't let us bring it inside. We had to leave it outside, and I think we had to just call somebody to come pick it up for the dump or something. But yeah, man, I got a really deep look into how some people live when I was doing that job, and it was pretty rough. And that was when I was going to school in Arkansas. So we'd have to go up, I was in Northwest Arkansas up in the Ozarks. Sometimes we'd have to go way into those hills to deliver stuff or pick up stuff. And it wasn't fun, man. You're always hearing the banjo in the back of your mind. It's just not exactly sure, because there's nobody around. You're in the middle of nowhere. You don't know what could happen to you.
I almost had a bunch of land up there like 20, 25 years ago.
It's very pretty. It's a real pretty part of the country, but there are some creatures that live out there.
Yeah, in 96, I drove cross country. We had a bunch of vacation time we had to use. carryover vacation time. We had to use it or lose it. So one of my friends and I both took 6.5 weeks off work, and we drove cross country. We went through St. Louis and Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah. We went to Vegas, California, San Francisco, several places, but San Francisco and San Diego. And when we came back, we went through Arkansas. We were going to go down to Louisiana, down on the piers, and do all that $5 all-you-can-eat soft-shelled crab and things like that on the piers. But we ran out of money in Arkansas and had to come back with just enough in to pay for our gas. But yeah, Arkansas was, we weren't planning on coming back to Ohio. We were trying to find a place to move. And I really hated California. Everybody raves about California, and I didn't like hardly anything about California.
You didn't like San Diego?
No, because I don't Spanish. our hotel caught fire. San Diego was just a nightmare.
I went the to first California, part of our California, and there was an earthquake.
yeah, that's another thing. Earthquakes.
I like San Diego. But Arkansas, it's a very walkable,
city. Arkansas was the one spot I was at where I was like, this is beautiful. I'd love to live here.
It's gorgeous. It really is. But there's just some people that live in those hills that never come down, and they've been there for generations. And it's almost just like the movies, you know. But if you're a nature lover, man, it's an awesome state.
Yeah, I really, really miss my grandparents had over 200 acres over in Dublin, suburb of Columbus, out in the country. And when we moved back to Ohio when I was 5, we lived over there. So my brother and I would go out and we would just disappear for the day. We were supposed to stay outside till supper time, and we'd be out exploring the woods and over 200 acres. It was awesome. And I think in the year 2000, the developers were just tearing everything up. I think on one weekend they mulched 200 acres of trees. They had these big machines that just ripped them up out of the ground. And they were just like giant, like Goliath, Samson, or David and Goliath, Goliath-sized mounds of mulch. Just stack after stack from destroying all the trees. Just saw all that land just get wiped out in a weekend. Yeah, it's beautiful to have experienced that growing up, and heartbreaking to see that destroyed.
Yeah,
I'd love to get back to that.
Yeah, it reminds me of the farm my grandparents in West Virginia had. Now there's not a trace of the farm. Of course, there was no big forest, or at least out near the road, there was no big forest. But they had a big equipment shed. They had a big barn. It is now a development. And, I mean, my grandparents' home is still there. Then again, you're not going to do much to a house which has been sheathed in hand-hewn sandstone bricks without explosives or a jackhammer.
Now, were they up in Appalachia?
Route 7, West Virginia, Masontown, a few miles from Morgantown, where the University of West Virginia is.
That's some of the prettiest part of the country, too, up there.
Yeah, there's Cooper's Rocks and stuff. I saw some country in there. I miss it, you know. That Take Me Home Country Roads thing really gets to me sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been a good show. We did lots of reminiscing. I bet some people remember a lot of the things we talk about, some listeners. Be interesting to hear some feedback. We forgot to... Is Cherry Hill still on in the mumble chat? I can find him.
Yep, he's there.
Cherry Hill?
Cherry.
Do you want to chat with us and tell us anything about your computer use through the years or your experience with computers? If he's listening, he might not be. In the meantime, do you got any tech topics or anything you want to discuss while we're here?
Isn't there stuff in the show notes?
Let me see here. Oh, you mean like the subreddit?
I know. We started a notes file last week and picked the movie and everything.
Yeah, he's got last movie is Gattaca, next movie is Laser Blast. But that's it.
That's it.
Yeah. I figured we'd save the movie talk until, you know, the boys get back or they'll want to talk about it. As far as the Reddit links, there's not really much.
For the movie, I don't know if you heard earlier, I got feedback from people at Self. Who asked us to shorten the talking about the movie at the beginning of the show.
Oh, yeah, I was going to bring that up too, because I listened to the last show, and I was actually fast-forwarding through the movie synopsis. I don't think it's necessary to talk about every scene of the movie. I think what you want to do is just kind of tease it so that it entices other people to actually watch it, you know? And you shouldn't spend an hour just talking about the movie, I don't think. Do a quick synopsis and then say a few things that you thought were interesting and then give it a rating and then just move on. I think that would work.
Must have been a dozen people I tried selling on joining the Lugcast at the show.
Really?
Yeah, it doesn't look like anybody joined. There were more from OLF.
Oh, speaking of OLF, has anybody heard about a date for OLF? Is it even happening?
We do have a date for Self 2024. It's confirmed. All the contracts are done, and it should be a lot bigger than this year.
Really? Nice.
Yeah, that was, I think, 2018. Maybe 2019, Jeremy did a talk where he talked about the history of Self, where Dave Yates, I believe, used to run it. And then Jeremy took it over from him and created a nonprofit around it. Nonprofit, not for profit. But at that Self, it was before the closing keynote, he discussed, you know, all these things that happened behind the scenes, that how Self was a copy of the Ohio Linux Fest. But they clearly do it better, because they have when Self starts, everything for the next year has already been taken care of, except for the speakers. They already have their the vendor booths and stuff are all lined up, the big names and stuff. So this year and last year were the exception, because they did the in person last year last minute. They had just lifted the COVID bans for meeting in public a few weeks before Self. So they threw the in-person in together very, very quick. And then it took them a while to get everything planned out for this year. But when they started this year, the badges have the dates and stuff for next year. But everything's already confirmed. And Jeremy, I overheard Jeremy talking to other people. I was kind of eavesdropping, or just happened over here. But it sounds like next year is already going to be closer to regular size Linux conference.
Nice.
This year was pretty small.
OLF, their official webpage, still talks about registration for 2022. And then their Facebook page, the last post is from April. So no updates. So we'll see if they actually have it or not. I would like to go. I definitely want to go to Self next year, though.
Yes, definitely. And I'm not driving again.
That's in North Carolina, right?
Charlotte, North Carolina. Yeah, it's a mile or two from the airport.
Yeah, I definitely want to go to that. So right now, it sounds like that's the biggest Linux Fest in the U.S., at least.
Texas was about the same size in 2019.
Yeah, they moved to Austin now.
Well, I thought they were rotating every year to a different city.
Oh, are they?
At least that's what they were talking about in 2019, yeah. Hmm. When I went, It was you were there, and 5150 was there, and
Joe.
Forget who else.
Joe was there.
Oh yeah, Joe was at the table. I forget what table he was at. Mintcast?
Yes. Tactics Last Fest. On their webpage anyway, it still says 2020. And then also they let their HTTPS cert expire. Well, they have a Twitter. Let's see what the Twitter says. Oh, I don't want to make an account.
Oh, somebody itself talked me into setting up a Keybase.io account.
Now, what is that?
Kind of like a prove your identity tool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you can create a PGP key or a GPG key, mm-hmm. Like for your identity to use with email and other things. I don't know if it has email storage also, like a vault. I don't know. I linked it to Twitter and GitHub and a couple other accounts. Mm-hmm. So your level of trust increases on the number of accounts that you link together, prove your identity on. And then you can install it on multiple devices, laptops, tablets, phones. So if something happens to one, you can turn off that device and still have all your authentication stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, I use KeyOxide. I wonder if that's similar. And I have that link to like my tech blog and Mastodon and stuff like that for my PGP key. As far as what I've been working on, I'm still trying to get the Lemmy page up. I keep having problems with the Docker build, and so I'm going to have to jump into the Lemmy Matrix channel and ask them. I have everything. I mean, I have my old Lemmy install, but it put, when I set it up, it put my root as the first partition on my on the VM I had it in, and I can't get it to, you know, I need to expand root because it's only 32 gigabytes right now, and so I don't, because boot and swap is after root, I have to move root to the end so I can expand it. And it's giving me issues. So I said, well, I'll just start over and create a new LXC. It's 128 gigabytes. That should be big enough. And so I have everything, all my config files set up right for Docker. And when I pull down the images, it just gets stuck on, say, build 0.0 seconds. And I have no idea why it's doing that. It shouldn't be building anything. It's just pulling images from Docker Hub, I think. But
Do you delete the image that you have downloaded currently?
Yeah. So yeah, actually, so what I did is just I took the LXC. I've got Debian 12 installed in it and Docker and all that stuff. And so I created all my config files, and then I just backed that up. And then, so I'll make a few changes on config file and try to run it. And then it just throws that building 0.0 second error and never goes away. So I'll kill it, and then I'll just pull the backup back up just in case, so I don't forget to, if there's something I forget to delete or something, I'll just start with a clean slate each time. And it's still giving me issues. I don't know why.
So are you using Docker Compose files?
Yeah.
Do you use a separate folder for each Docker Compose, for each application Docker container you're building?
Yeah. So this is the only folder. This is the only thing I'm installing in this LXC is Lemmy, you know. And it should run fine. I don't think I had this problem when I first installed it. But it's after it pulls all the images, but then it says building 0.0 seconds, and it just stays like that. I don't know why. It's got to be something in the Lemmy config file. It uses a JSON file to config for all your volumes and stuff like that. But I don't know. I'll have to get on there. And then another thing I wanted to ask you, Mordenski. It seems like you've been messing with this lately. I bought this little cheap MIDI keyboard. Here it is right here. And it, you know, because I wanted to make some music with Reaper on my laptop, and it detects it. Reaper detects it, but it like I'll load up a virtual instrument and I'll play something, and then it like sometimes I get a note and sometimes I don't get a note, and or sometimes I can barely hear it, and sometimes it's like super loud and I don't. Something's going on with the way it's interpreting this keyboard, and I can't figure out what's going on. I mean, it's running through Pipewire. I'm using Fedora and Reaper. Reaper is the DAW. And I don't have you. Do you have you hooked up any MIDI instruments or MIDI controllers to any of your computers?
No, not yet. I have an Alesis 88 to connect to it. 688.
And I was told this one works with Linux, and I watched a couple of videos that people are using it with Linux, not necessarily Fedora, but other DAWs and other OSs, so other distros. Somebody using what's the big one, LMM something like that. But anyway, so I'll just keep messing with that. See if maybe this weekend I can get it working right. It may have something to do with Pipewire and Jack or something like that. Other than that, that's about all I've been doing. So, anybody else have anything they want to add before we sign out of here?
I was having problems with Mumble, and if you get a chance, you may want to see if you can go back to Pulse Audio.
And see, you mean to handle audio on my laptop?
If your Pipewire stuff is not working.
Yeah.
You may want to see if you can go back to a Pulse Audio channel, because a lot of stuff may not be updated for Pipewire yet.
Yeah, that's true. I could even try ALSA, you know, if that doesn't work. But maybe I'll do that. I'll just try another audio.
I mean, that's what happened when I was having trouble with my microphone and Mumble. Is I just selected back to Pulse Audio, and everything worked out. You know, I could configure things the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, I really didn't even think about it, because from what I've read, everybody's saying, oh, Pipewire solves all these problems, and it's so much easier to work with Linux Audio now, which I haven't really been involved with Linux Audio and that scene in a long time, because I just haven't done anything with it. But yeah, I may just go back and try Pulse Audio, which from I have an interface for Jack, so I can switch from Pipewire to Pulse Audio pretty easily. What about you, Lovecraft? Anything else you want to throw in there?
Nothing yet. I may be getting a Surface 6. I think Joe might have some experience getting Linux on some of those devices, so I may hit him up if I do get this device. See what we can do with that.
That's a nice little device. I've got the original Surface. Actually, it's the Surface RT. So when I got the one with the little ARM chip in it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So I'm hoping I'm going to get this. I'll probably know in another week or so, but that might be an interesting little project that hopefully I can devote some time to.
Yeah, for sure. We don't really have much to add to the notes. As far as the Reddit goes, don't really see anything pressing that needs to be talked about.
I think we should change notes to the movie stuff into 223.
Okay.
And then just put this was an ad hoc episode.
Yeah, let's do that.
Blue Moon, a non-episode.
Hold on, let me create 223 real quick.
Yeah, well, Do we have another Friday this month?
Do we? Let's see. The 23rd is next Friday. Yeah.
The 30th.
Yeah, sure do. Just copying and pasting into 223. Do that out. Let's see, what else did we talk about? A little bit about Linux Fest. Jobs. So, July 7th will be the next official show. I guess this was an official show. But I don't know about doing a show at the end of the month or not. I mean, it's up to you guys if you want to.
And a Blue Moon show?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to? Okay.
I'm game.
Why not?
Yeah, that'll be on the 30th. Let's see. Wait, no. Yes, that's right. It's the last day of the month. Okay. I think. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's see. I'm gonna go ahead and sign us out of here. Tony ever responded? Nope. All right. That comes up on the end of the show. This was kind of a walk down memory lane show. For all the grandpas out there, and we may or may not have a show, Blue Moon show, on June 30th. I will probably be there, and a tentative calendar ad, Blue Moon show, so we'll see about that. If we don't, the next recording date will be July 7th. Our music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. We would like to thank Delwyn for the use of his Mumble server. Finally, we would like to give a special thanks to Father Finch, Fweeb, Dave Morris, and Tony Bemis for all their help and support over the years. For the Linux Lugcast, I have been Minix, and y'all have a good night. Next. Anybody else want to sign off?
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
That's Morton C.
This is Net Miner.
I think I'm supposed to say everybody's name, right?
Good night. Yeah.
Sorry about that. Lovecraft.
Good night, everybody.
Morton C.
Hey. Okay.
And how can we forget our patriarch Netminer?
Yes, well, think of me as a sober 5150.
Sounds good to me. Also in the chat, as always, is Cherry Hill Tony. Thanks for joining us. And y'all have a safe weekend and a good night. Hello, boys.
Hello, Minix.
Netminer, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, but I've been listening to YouTube, so I didn't want it to go into the recording.
Oh, that's fine. I'm just now recording.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Netminer.
What's up, Lovecraft?
Not much. How you doing?
Not bad.
Well, tell Elle that I've missed her emails.
Her and I have both been really busy. I have like four projects going on at work. Most days I'm on four consoles at the same time.
I'm aware things get busy, but just let her know that when she has time, I welcome them.
Yes, I will. She's waiting on me and her to both have time to read the emails together.
Yes, well, I'm not trying to push anything. I'm just trying to show that I welcome her, anything that she said.
Absolutely. I will let her know. I'm going to call her after the podcast. How's Lovecraft?
Is there a Lovecraft in the house?
Yeah, can you guys hear me?
I do now.
Cool. How you been?
Okay. I did spill a Red Bull on both my laptop and my Chromebook right before the podcast.
Oh, no. That's terrible. Were they turned on at the time?
Yes. So far, nothing's happened. I sopped up everything with paper towels real quick. But
they haven't sped up?
They haven't sped up. They haven't picked up the bad nicotine habit, smoking.
Well, that's good news.
I've seen videos where people try to destroy Chromebooks, even dipping them in liquid nitrogen, and they keep on going.
With liquid nitrogen? Wow, that sounds pretty cool. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I think the video I saw, the touchpad peeled off, and that was about it.
Nice.
Balls. 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 Balls.
I think this is just about all it's going to be here tonight. I don't think Joe and Honky are going to make it tonight. We have virtual Honky. Anything y'all been working on or watching or reading, listening to?
Finally finished Dark Angel season 2, and it was just as disappointing as Joe led me to believe.
Yeah, I heard you guys talking about it on the last show. And how many seasons are there?
Just 2.
Oh, okay.
So that really only one that's any good. The first one, the second season was just too disjointed, too all over the place, and just it ended weird.
So you could have left off at the end of season 1 and been good.
Yeah, I think that would have been a lot better. It was just it was too all over the place and just not a good spot to end on. It was they were just meandering all over, were trying to bring in new characters, and yeah, they should have just stuck with the formula for season 1.
Have you ever seen Red Dwarf?
A little bit. I've never really watched it in order, just bits and pieces here. I had a friend who's really into like some of that British stuff, Red Dwarf, Blake 7, all that stuff. But yeah, I never really got that into it.
I started rewatching. I hadn't seen it in years and years, and I started rewatching it. And the first 5 seasons were still really good. And then they took, I think, maybe a 5-year break after season 5. And when they brought it back, one of the main characters were missing. And they took away the laugh track. They made all these weird changes. And then that's season 6. And I was just like, I think the first 5 seasons is probably enough to rewatch. But seems like when people start messing with the good formula, why would you do that, you know?
Yeah, a lot of times after a show takes a long break or something, it might not be same writers or something. They're kind of just bringing it back to make money, maybe, you know, I don't know. And then I think that just the fans get all excited and then let down inevitably.
Yeah, you have kind of doesn't live up to the hype you generated previously. So I watched that movie Men. That was kind of interesting. Really weird. I like that director though, that Alex Garland. He did Ex Machina, and I thought this one would be really good. And it, I don't know. All I can say is it's really weird and didn't go where I thought it was going to go. Had a crazy ending though. Other than that, I haven't really watched anything of note. No shows really. Reruns of the X-Files on TV. And
it's on Comet?
Yeah, on Comet.
Yeah, I actually went through and probably watched just about every episode about, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago. I was DVRing a few and just, you know, watching them. And saw just about everyone again. Good show. It's definitely worth watching reruns of.
Oh yeah, that is a good show. It kind of suffers towards the end of when Duchovny left and Robert Patrick just takes his place, which he's still good, but they just don't have the same chemistry as Dana and
Oh
Bob
yeah, it was oh yeah, it
Smolder.
was definitely missing that dynamic that they played off of each other so well.
Yeah,
But
I can't remember. Was that he was like holding out for more money or something? I can't remember what the reason was.
yeah,
Yeah, it was something like
specifically
that.
Seinfeld. Everybody on Seinfeld was getting over $1 million per episode, and he said, "I need that too." And they said, "You're not needed for the show to succeed." Was my recollection of what happened.
Was he making the same as Gully on there?
That I don't know.
I wonder.
Have you seen any of the more recent episode, whether it was season 10 or an 11 or whatever they did?
I need to sit down and watch them all the way through. I think I've caught parts of the new seasons. One I watched was pretty good, and then I just haven't really sat down and watched them. But did you watch them?
Yeah, a couple of them were really good. There was a couple of bullet duds, but they were you could tell that the writing was really trying to recapture some of that dynamic between the two of them, and I think it hit it with a couple of episodes, not so much with a few others.
Yeah, that was on Fox, right? Fox brought it back for
Yep,
two
yeah, I think they did like
seasons.
s maybe six episode seasons. I think it was like season 10 and 11 or whatever. There was a good break between the two, though, if I recall correctly.
I saw the one where they introduced, like, supposedly the new Fox and Scully, the blonde chick, or maybe she was redhead chick and brunette guy, and they were trying to figure out where these terrorists were going to strike, and one of the guys that had committed a suicide bombing was in a coma. He was still alive, so they were trying to connect with him, and David Duchovny's character took some mushrooms to try to, like, I don't know, spiritually connect with them or something. It was kind of weird.
Yeah, was he riding like in that like psychedelic sequence? Was he like riding a bull or something like that?
Yeah,
Like a,
they're in a boat
I
and stuff.
yeah, I think I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the only one I saw all the way through, I think. But yeah, I'll go back sometime and watch it.
Did you ever see the spin-off show, the Lone Gunman show that did one season?
No, I never watched that either. Was that any good?
It was a little weird because they didn't let the lone gunman just stand on their own. They had to introduce like a kind of like a beefcake muscle guy, and then there was like an attractive female who was like their arch nemesis, and it just didn't work too well.
No, I really liked them on the original show. In fact, the last episode of X-Files I watched on Comet was their introduction to the show when they were at some convention and they worked for the FCC and stuff, and they were totally square and weren't into conspiracy. It was kind of funny.
Oh yeah, I think is that the one where the guy's playing like Dungeons and Dragons in the back room or something like that? I think yeah.
That woman shows up who says she's being followed and they don't know if they should believe her or not, and she's got a tracking device in her tooth that she pulls out and they check it out under a microscope and they're like, wow, there's really something going on,
Yeah, the X-Files episodes with the Lone Gunman were some of my favorites. The other show, I don't know. If you can find it, you might want to give it a shot, but I don't think it's
Yeah.
gonna really resonate that well with you.
I'll check it out. I'll probably make a little marathon of the Lone Gunman and the new seasons of the X-Files and watch that. So, what about you, Mordency? What, you been watching anything, or you just been busy?
I saw the new Arnold Schwarzenegger show on Netflix, FUBAR.
It's like a
It's like a
multi-part
multi-part
documentary, kind of, right?
No, not the documentary. It's
Oh.
I think by the same I think it's based on a book or compared to Reacher.
Oh, okay.
He's a CIA agent retiring, and then they pull him in to help extract somebody. He finds out he reluctantly goes in to help extract an agent, and it turns out to be his daughter.
Wow.
Yeah, and then that whole thing goes through. I also watched The Night Agent. I don't know if that was before the last podcast or.
There was a movie you mentioned on the last show that sounded interesting to me. And I can't remember what it was called. I should have wrote it down. Dang it. It was the vampire one. What was it called? Slayers?
Yes.
Do you like that one?
Yeah.
Who did it have? Who was the main character? Thomas Jane, right?
Yeah, Thomas Jane.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, I like him a lot, so, I mean, I'll check it out just for him. I liked him in Punisher and The Expanse. And I got to meet him at a comic book festival one time. It was kind of cool. Seems like a nice guy.
Yeah, it was very campy. There was some cool, you know, like comic book styling from mm-hmm. time to time in it. I didn't hate it. I enjoyed watching it.
Pretty breezy watch.
Yeah. Star Trek, the one that follows the Enterprise before Kirk.
Oh yeah.
Strange World. Strange.
How's universe. That?
How's that?
Is that Captain Pike?
Yeah, it's Captain Pike and Spock. There's even something where he has seen his death. Which is why he's not afraid of any scenario that's occurring, because he knows that's not how he's going to die.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. Remember the aliens with the big heads?
The aliens with the big heads. From the original series or what?
From the original series where they steal Pike. Where he's in the chair. And
oh yeah, that, yeah. He's got that weird metal chair thing that he's encased in. Yeah, I remember that. He sees himself in that.
I don't know if he sees himself in that, but in the first season, they referenced that he had gone to some place like a, I think it was Vulcan or a Klingon religious place where you can. There's crystal there or something, and you can see your death. You can
Wasn't see he like you're burned die. Or something too? Like his face was his fucked face up. Was I can't remember.
In Star Trek, the original series, yeah he was all yeah. The new Walking Dead, Dead City, I think.
I didn't know there was
one.
Yeah. Fear of the Walking Dead is ending soon. This season, it's only got a few episodes left. Eight episodes, I think they're half through. And they're supposed to have two or three spin-offs. But the original show, Fear of the Walking Dead, and that two season one that they did, Brave New World.
World Beyond.
Fear of the Walking Dead is the only one that's still going, and it's ending this season. It's on its final season. And I think they have three more spin-offs. The first one has Maggie and Negan in it so far. They're supposed to have Michonne and Rick in another one. And I don't know about the third one. I don't know when they're starting.
Now, wasn't Negan a bad guy, I thought?
Well, so one of the running themes and in these shows is that they always focus on who the hero is. The whatever group they're following is the hero. But if they follow anybody else that you think is a villain, they could be seen as the hero because, you know, we're never the villain in our own story.
Right.
So Negan, they did a backstory for Negan where they went back at the beginning of the outbreak, and he's taking care of his wife, who has a stage four cancer, and he's pretty much gets bullied around by people, and you see him, you see how he becomes Negan and why he names the bat Lucille and everything else. It's pretty much to protect people from the villains that were out there.
Did he have to kill Glenn like that, though?
Well, that was, well, I mean, when you look at that specific episode, what had happened right before that? With no provocation, Rick's group went and slaughtered an entire building of the Saviors. Right? So if a random group of people attacked a group of yours, what would you do?
Yeah.
So instead of killing all of them, he makes an example out of one of them. So, yeah. Yeah, yes, but overall, he's the villain for, what, a season or two of The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And then there's a couple seasons where he's getting redemption, where he's mostly redeemed.
That's about where I quit watching it, was around when they introduced Negan.
As far as darkness goes, that's about as dark as it got right about then. I think you'd like watching to the end to see everything that happened, the new villains that pop up and yeah.
What else?
I started watching Crazed. I haven't got very far into it.
Is that a series?
A movie.
A movie.
I think this season of From's almost. Second season of From's almost over.
Yeah, I heard y'all talking about that.
Just as wacky and as bizarre as the first season.
That's when they're trapped in that town that you can't get out of, right?
Yeah, they're trapped in the town. I think I mentioned it on the last show. Barry ended.
Yeah, Barry's over.
Barry's over. I think The Flash ended also. But with I think this is the downtime for seasons. I think we're between seasons of shows. I don't think there's been much out that I've watched other than Jeopardy and a couple single episodes of stuff. Almost done watching Shameless. Oh, overall, it's just a downtime.
Jerry Hill, Tony's with us.
I wish I had
in the chat. How you doing, Tony? Joe's in, Florida, I believe, and I think Honky is here in Dallas somewhere. So it's just us tonight.
And I went with Hopper to.
I can't hear you. Warnsy.
Hello?
I can hear
you.
Can
you hear me?
I can.
Well, I went to the Southeast Linux Fest.
With Hopper. I see you lighting up, but I don't hear you. Lovecraft, do you hear him?
I do. Can you hear me?
Oh, so y'all can hear me, but I can't hear you. Okay. That's not good.
I noticed Lugbot muted. Could that be why? No.
Test. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I can hear you.
I can't hear you guys. Dang it. I'm not muted.
Turning it off and turning it back on help.
Test.
I can hear you.
I still can't hear you guys. What is going on?
I told several people about the Linux Lugcast. Why was it the Southeast Linux?
I think it's my headphones.
I can see that no one has joined so far. I did hear a complaint about the show.
What was that?
Our movie reviews go too long, that we should have a shorter, more concise description of the movie and not ramble on for 2 hours.
Can you hear? All right. I think that fixed it.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I can hear you.
I don't know what happened. Mumble was muted within my audio control panel, but not within the application itself. Very weird. I must have hit a shortcut that I'm just not aware of. But I actually quit Mumble. So I'll have to join the two recordings together. Well, why don't we just go ahead and start the show before I screw anything else up, you know? Unless there's something else you want to talk about.
Nothing pre-show.
Okay. Well, I just started to record a new stream, so we might as well start now. Let me get the notes up here. Oh, episode 220.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
Oh my God, it's Hacker Public Radio. Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net/techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Flying Rich, he's a bloody drunk.
If you don't like a guest, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that'll get back.